All right. Go ahead and fire questions as we go, and give me a 5 minutes heads up. Hopefully this will all fit. So I want to first just kind of set the stage here and explain why is it that I'm making such a big deal out of this? And what is it that I think we need to do as a community and an industry in trying to get aggressive about botnets and do it in a way that's acceptable to the public? I've got a bunch of case studies, and there won't be enough time to go over all of them. Ask questions if you have any about some of the details, and hopefully conclude with some thoughts for the future. So we're regularly now seeing people who are complaining about law enforcement isn't working, the bad guys are still out there. People sometimes use self-defense arguments. I should be able to strike back if someone's striking at me. And there was a takedown last September of the Calijos botnet by Kaspersky. On their blog, they had an informal survey, and 85% of the people that responded said Kaspersky should be pushing code to clean up those infected computers. There have been a number of people that have been looking at writing worms to try and clean up Storm, Configure, et cetera. And think about what happens if you're trying to clean up, potentially reboot computers without the owner's knowledge, without knowing where they are, without knowing what they're doing. And Kaspersky, CrowdStrike, and Dell SecureWorks, some members of the HoneyNet project were involved, took down Calijos again. And if you look at their blog, they have, and this is going to be kind of hard for you to read, they have at the very end, what do we do now that we've taken this down? Well, we did a survey before, and 85% of the people clearly said they wanted to clean things up. So the only solution is to actually go clean these computers up. And theoretically, we could do that, but it's illegal. So what do we propose? We propose changing laws. We want to allow mass remediation via botnets. We want warrants for immunity from cybercrime laws in case we accidentally do something that causes harm. We want to be able to use the resources of these compromised computers to go out and kind of go after the bad guys and give warrants for remote exploitation of these systems, the third-party systems. Janet Napolitano, in a talk, I believe last week, was also saying going on the offensive is something that should be considered. Corporations should be trying to look at ways of doing this. And what we need to understand is that as you try to go from at the very bottom here, just passive observation at your border, looking at flows, going into sandboxes, where you're actually now seeing the effects of the bot, but it's still kind of passive, moving on towards stealing credentials, allowing you to execute commands within the botnet, to taking it over, being able to execute commands and control the botnet the same way that the bad guys do, up to sinkholing and takedown operations where you're trying to take control away from the bad guy, and at the very far extreme, and obviously there's no scale on here, but I'm trying to imply risk and technical difficulty go way, way up when you start talking about now we want to actually go out and clean these computers. So when we have a situation like that where we're doing this nominally to help innocent third parties, if we start doing things that cause harm to those third parties, we will end up in a situation where what the European community is debating right now, simple possession of malware, potentially is a crime. Going out and manipulating hosts may become a crime. So some of the things that we're doing may become problematic.
Quick question. So when you say possession of malware, what does that mean? So like, you know, you have malware samples? Is that a crime or is it?
I haven't. Well, the EC proposals I do not believe are public right now. They're still sort of in debate. But the discussion has been possession of malicious software, attack tools that would allow you to break in.
Like in Germany, yeah.
Yeah. And it would be similar to in the States here, the actual possession of lock picks is illegal unless you have a lock pick certification. So we might be heading in that kind of a situation. So I want to say, if we're going to try and go out there and do these risky things, there should be some kind of a minimum bar. The job is hard, but we need to make sure that we're doing things in a way that is justifiable. So what do we need to do? Well, we need to name things better. We have a really difficult time right now using names. I now hate using the term bot and botnet, because those terms are so meaningless in a complex malware environment. And we've got problems in counting, and quantitatively there are issues. People obviously want to be claiming credit for taking down the biggest, baddest botnet, but that has a tendency to sort of miss some of the smaller things. So as Ferg was talking about, there have been a number of small botnets. Joe Stewart, I think in 2004, was saying Core Flood at the time. Nobody was paying attention to it because the numbers were in the tens of thousands. They only wanted to go after the things that were in the multi-hundreds of thousands or the millions. Ferg was talking about the complexity of malware droppers and spamming and cash out, money mule. You know, there is this rich environment that we don't seem to do a really good job of correlating. There are some studies that are out there that are doing a better job of this. And we also need to try to share information that we have in a more automated way, trying to get to the point of being able to be more agile and to have more certainty about the actions that we're taking. And finally, we need to start demonstrating integrity, demonstrating that we understand what the ethical issues are, what the risks are, risks and benefits, and do things more in the way that biomedical and behavioral researchers have to do today to justify taking risks. I should not have done timing because this thing is going a little bit fast. So the terms bot and botnet, I hate them. And we keep coming up with new terms. You know, there are exploit kits, browser exploit packs. What's the difference between a injection server and a drive-by download server and an exploit kit? I mean, they all functionally behave the same. So if we at least had some sort of thesaurus or some way of describing these things and saying, okay, well, this is known by this group as a dropper, but we're calling it here an exploit kit, that would be one step towards trying to have a little bit more rigor. This is one of the examples of how this becomes a problem. We've got bots that are out spamming. They send you URLs. The URLs direct you to a site, and here's where the black hole exploit kit that Ferg was talking about comes into play. There are multiple exploits that are used, media files, PDF, JRE, Flash. Those each have, you know, MD5 hashes that we track and CVE numbers. So we'll look at the little tiny things here and there and say, oh, well, we triggered on this at our IPS. We triggered at this on our AV. Those things then, if they work, there is this thing, C-inject, which injects into a process. It doesn't actually act like a dropper. So some people will say it's not a dropper because it's not actually putting things on disk. But it's also being used to drop Zeus. So is it a dropper, is it not a dropper? You know, some of the terms become meaningless almost. And you've got multi-phase activity for something like Torpig and MebRoot. MebRoot is the root kit. There are DLLs that are used to control how this thing installs code. Torpig gets installed. Now Torpig becomes a keylogger. It sends things to or it gets its configuration file for what it's trying to steal, sends things to a caching server, can be used to propagate itself by involving an injection server. So if we're only looking at one part of this and then doing a sandbox analysis and throwing it, the analysis report out there, how is it helping in trying to tie all of this activity together in a way that we can actually say, we can stop the whole thing, not we can stop the command and control, or we can stop the infection. And we have situations where we, as an industry, or as researchers working with industry, will throw some numbers out. And Alex Landstein's one of the people that I know is out there trying really hard to get people to be more rigorous about numbers. Some numbers are thrown out, 12 million or 13 million infections. It goes into a media story. It gets picked up by policymakers. They turn around and repeat this. So people potentially are making policy at the national level based on really bad information coming in. And most people would say, no, it's not 12 million. But what is the real number? We're not giving counting methodology often. We're not giving the time frame over which the count was derived. We're not giving error rates. So what happens? We end up having partial data and trying to go out and do things, especially if we're working in small groups, especially if it's volunteer effort, trying to do something, make an action based on partial information, which means your results may not be quite what you expect. So this is actually new since the paper was submitted. Delk, Kaspersky, and CrowdStrike took down Kalihos. So there was a version of Kalihos. They knew that it was being installed by a pay-per-install mechanism, but didn't really look outside of this box. So the sinkhole worked. The sinkhole took the botnet command and control out of the hands of the bad guys. So there were, you know, 100 and something thousand, 110, 119, depending on the count, hosts that now are sinkholed. But what wasn't really clear, because at the time nobody did this kind of analysis, there's this thing called FIFSOC, which is affecting Twitter and Facebook users, and it's a worm that goes out and tries to infect friends, steal credentials, goes to those friends, worm your way around. So it drops code. It dropped Kalihos B. It also dropped this thing called WinWebSec. So WinWebSec is fake AV. So it tries to scam you. So the green line is scamming. It sends spam for propagation, so the purple line is spam. There are a bunch of domains that are used. These domains show up in the analysis of a whole bunch of these tools, but we're not really putting the picture together very well. So right, like within days after the sinkhole took place, people were saying, no, you guys didn't take that thing down. It's still being propagated. FIFSOC is still sending them out to Facebook users, or trying to. So yeah, there's a variant. Keys were changed. Some minor code had been changed. But the Kalihos operators have a Kalihos C variant now that's still doing the same old thing. So was it a success? In a way, it took 100 and something thousand hosts out of the bad guys' control. But no, in that they're still doing the same thing within days after the takedown. So this is an updated slide from the one that's in the paper. The links here now are going to be a little bit different, and the table number is different. But if you add in the new Kalihos takedown, you can see that there are a large number of bots that have been around for a while. CoreFlood, the oldest one here, 10 years. So most of these things will last for multiple years. In the case of Mariposa, it's all of a sudden the biggest botnet in the world after just a few months. Nobody recognized it before. Things like CoreFlood out there in such small numbers for such a long period of time that nobody really pays attention to it. Then some takedown action occurs. If Kaspersky and Dell are correct, Wolodec was a follow-on of Storm. Kalihos was a follow-on of Wolodec. Now there has been another one. So it went from 10 months from the Wolodec takedown to the first Kalihos takedown, to 4 months from the first Kalihos takedown and the second one, and then within a week, Kalihos C is out there. So is that five successes or is it one failure? Like it's not really clear. I'm now kind of qualifying some of these successes. I think that the legal action that Microsoft took in trying to go after compelling people to do things, I think that is effective. It's really risky for you to say no to a court order telling you to do something. But in the case of, for example, the Mariposa botnet, when the takedown took place, somebody was supposedly bribed to give one of the domains back. The bad guy took control again of the botnet, turned around, used it to attack the people that were trying to do the takedown, which caused somewhere between 4 to 12 hours worth of downtime, somewhere around 900 megabits per second DDoS attack. And it was an accident, the bad guy not using his VPN to log in during this kind of battle to take control, that exposed the person's IP address, allowing law enforcement to actually go after them. So some harm occurred, the takedown didn't quite work. If that person that was supposedly bribed to give the domain back had been given a court order saying do this, and then they would have given it back, they would have potentially been facing jail time or charges at least of disobeying a court order. When you do it voluntarily though, okay, maybe you can try and make a case that he was bribed, but actually having legal process to compel people is more effective than cooperative kinds of actions. So, how much more time do I have? All right, okay. So if we start looking at, you know, what can we learn from some of these? Size estimates vary by sometimes 2 to 3 orders of magnitude between entities that are putting numbers out. And there's obviously an incentive to inflate numbers, so that's going to be kind of hard to deal with. And there's this conflation of infection with IP address count. So this is some really good data. This is from the CrowdStrike blog on the Kalihos takedown. It shows something similar to what the guys at UCSB found when they were analyzing Torpig. Torpig and Kalihos both have unique identifiers which have pretty good entropy, and they're obtainable without having to use signed commands. So you can sort of uniquely ID the bots. And if you look, here's this diurnal pattern of command request activity. The green line is the line of unique IDs seen over time. The blue line is the line of unique IP addresses seen over time. So there was a paper that Savage and I can't remember who did it, availability of peer-to-peer bots in like 2004 or something. And they showed that it was something like 50% of hosts in a peer-to-peer network changed their IP address within 4 days. So, and there have been other studies, I think Bhagwan's study on botnets had something like 40% of hosts, when you're crawling, could not be contacted. Vern?
The churn really varies from ISP to ISP.
Yeah.
So one, it's dangerous to have a typical number in mind.
Exactly, right. So that's why I'm saying counting methodology has to be provided, the count period has to be provided. We need to have a better way of identifying what the probability is that IP addresses will change and what's the lifetime within certain ISPs. But this does sort of give you some evidence that in this particular case, you can see that it's about a 3-to-1 error after 5 days.
So if I'm not mistaken, the graph actually shows that not too many people are getting infected over time, right? So it's sort of saturated.
In this case, this is the sinkhole botnet.
Ah, okay.
So there were no new infections.
Okay.
During that period of time. These are just the hosts that are coming online. And some of them do kind of come and go over time. They immediately get poisoned. Sure, question?
If I was writing a botnet, the first thing I do is put a unique identifier in every computer so I would know how many infections I have. Is there anything like going back? Have we seen anything for...
Yeah, lots and lots of bots have unique identifiers. Some you can get to, others you can't. Oh. So the Nagash botnet that I was looking at in 2008, the command to get the UUID was digitally signed with a 4096-bit RSA key. So
not going to help you too
much. Not going to help.
Yeah, yeah. No. Thanks.
But others, it's just sort of volunteered up. Here's one instance, Microsoft's Zeus takedown. You know, thousands of pages of documentation, thousands of domains identified, and probably can't read this very well, but the host, each of the domains was identified by its activity. So drop zone, source, source is where the binary was, embedded JavaScript for the drive-by download, drop zone, where the information's deposited, infector, I'm not sure the differences between infector and the embedded JS, and updater. So they've at least gone through and identified the role of each domain, and some have multiple roles. So I'll still kind of claim that if you're using legal process, you have somewhat better results, and that if you're only using technical means, the majority of the takedowns that only involve technical means didn't really work very well. The one thing that using legal process does that is a really nice byproduct that I'm really trying to encourage people to understand is it really clearly defines the ethics as well as the legality of what you're doing, because all the stakeholders are identified. How they're being harmed, how they benefit from crime, it's all identified. What the likelihood is of being able to achieve some objective is described. The steps that have to be taken, you then ask the court, grant me this order. That order compels people who otherwise may be uncooperative to do certain things. And the court is vetting what happens before it happens. Whereas most of these other takedowns, when people justify what they've done, it's in sort of ad hoc way, or someone will say, well, I believe that's unethical, but they won't really state any kind of principle. So in conclusion, you know, we're in an arms race. We as a community sometimes fail what Stephen Carter describes as integrity, being able to define right from wrong, being able to make decisions even if it has personal cost to us, and then being able to stand up and openly explain how you came to that decision of what's right and what's wrong. And since the cost of attacking is so much less than the cost of countering attacks, if we're going to try and go aggressive to go after them, the cost of being thorough is significantly higher than the cost of cutting corners. And if we cut corners and increase the risk, we're not really doing the job in a way that is going to be justifiable in the long term. And if something goes bad, we're going to be in trouble for it. So as David Dagon says, you know, instead of making pie charts, we should be focusing on these things as a crime scene and trying to look at it that way and deal with it, not as a research project. So, you know, I think there are many different ways for us to do a much better job. And with that, I will take questions. Thank you.
So my question was about the courts reviewing applications. To what extent, in your experience, are they, should we say, competent to review the information? You obviously, a lot of the stuff that you're dealing with is very technical in nature. Do you find the court system to be experienced enough or able to get the right people to make the right decisions?
That's a really good question. So I have been involved now in three different ex parte TRO court actions, and my role in those was to try to put in layman's terms what these technical concepts are, and that is hard to do. There aren't many people that do it well, so I'm encouraging people to go talk to lawyers and be able to have conversations with them and have them understand what it is that we're talking about so that it's not totally technical. And the second part of that question is, yes, it is hard to find either courts or lawyers who have the technical expertise. Microsoft happened to hire some really, really competent ones, and I could have very technical conversations with them, and they would pick it up, but others, not quite so much. So this is one of those things that will take some time, I think. But now that Microsoft has actually gone through this four times, there is at least, it's not precedent, but there is case law that can be relied upon to try to help bring people up to speed. So I think there is hope for it.
Can Alexandro sign up while we?
Yeah, thanks. I completely agree with your assessment that we need to name things better. Are you aware of any, as an example, I still have to find a good way to describe the people who actually do this. I mean, there are malfeasance, there are miscreants, there are bad guys, and there are hackers, everybody's favorite. Are you aware of any, nationwide efforts, programs that are out there to simply, standardize or harmonize all the nomenclature that we have for all the terms we have in this industry?
Yeah, really quickly, I'm forgetting the country that did it, but there have been a couple of industry efforts to sort of define a taxonomy. And right offhand, I'm spacing, but there was some country in Europe that tried to define sort of indicators of compromise style description of what these roles are in a complex malware environment, how you would classify them in a way that has some meaning that can then be used for legal process. So I'm trying to identify those and encourage use of those, so right offhand.
Not here though, right?
In the States?
Yeah, in the States. Anybody know of anything like that?
Yeah, nothing's coming to mind right now.
All right, thank you.